Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefit. He has a new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And Peter, you along with a number of former intelligence officers from the National Security Agency and from the CIA, the group of which you are a member, Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, have written a memorandum to the President of the United States asking him for urgent action on Ukraine and calling for an Obama-Putin summit on Ukraine. Tell me about where that stands. Has that been sent to the White House?
It has, and we're still waiting for Obama to return the call. But I think what's important and why we chose to send this letter advocating for a summit of some kind is that the United States needs to recall that diplomacy is a critical part of its foreign policy and its work overseas. We have seen in both my organization and through simply following the media that more and more America now jumps from step one to step five, immediately going back towards sanctions, immediately invoking the threat of military force, and seems to have forgotten that diplomacy oftentimes, in fact, when it's serious, always involves talking to people who you don't like, who may be your enemies, whose interests are not immediately aligned with yours. That's kind of the whole point of it. And simply to say, well, we don't agree with what Putin's doing, and so therefore we're not going to talk to him, in hopes that should the crisis boil over, we might be able to leave him a voicemail, really isn't the way that foreign policy should be conducted.
Well, the latest from the White House appears to be that they have convinced a number of chief executives of big U.S. corporations not to attend a summit that Putin is putting on for foreign businessmen investing in Russia coming up in a couple of weeks. It effectively puts these executives in a no-win situation. They don't want to offend the White House. At the same time, they don't want to offend Putin, who's likely to cut off their business dealings with Russia. So if this is the best move that we can make, it doesn't sound particularly robust in the sense that I don't see this situation in Ukraine getting any better. It's getting worse. I mean, there's likely to be a full-scale war at any moment. I just don't get the sense of urgency, which I guess is, you know, aside from whether or not Putin we have any leverage over him, short of these sanctions. I just don't get the sense of urgency here that the world community recognizes what a dangerous situation is underway in Ukraine.
It's a very difficult thing to parse out, but looking specifically at America's actions, the things that are coming out of the White House are almost, and I don't mean to be disingenuous, are almost akin to President Obama asking those business executives to unfriend Putin on Facebook. These gestures are symbolic at the very best, oftentimes, as you put it, forcing American businesses into awkward situations that accomplish very, very little. Putin understands that people need to do business with him and with Russia, and is unfortunately playing the game of politics and diplomacy far, far better than anybody here in Washington. It was clear over the Syrian crisis that Putin had been at this a little bit longer than we had. And now again with the Ukraine, the United States has failed to really articulate what its goal is in this situation, other than to stop the Russians from whatever their goal is, and has failed to line up its allies, failed to articulate a strategy, and finds itself just sort of stumbling around in the dark. It's unfortunately far too reminiscent of the early days of the War on Terror, where wars were started and alliances were snubbed in service of goals that were pretty hard to actually discern.
Well, I understand also, in spite of the fact that since 9/11 we've spent some enormous amounts of money on both the Pentagon and on the intelligence services, with all of this privatization and going on, and I think the intelligence budget has just gone through the roof. I don't know whether it's been doubled from Cold War levels, but it's huge compared to what it used to be. And yet we learn that Secretary of State John Kerry was completely blindsided by the Putin's invasion of Crimea. So, I mean, what's your sense from the group that you're a part of, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, that sent this letter to the White House calling for an Obama-Putin summit on Ukraine? What's the sense amongst your colleagues of what we're getting for all of this money we're spending on intelligence? If the Secretary of State doesn't even know what this big move is underway, and he's talking to Lavrov, and meanwhile, suddenly they take Crimea, what does that say about our intelligence capabilities?
It raises some very serious questions. But I think I'm going to suggest something even more serious than perhaps simple incompetence or sloppy work on the intelligence agency's part. So that certainly is something worth considering and probably certainly a factor. And the issue that remains even more troublesome to me is the question of exactly who the intelligence agencies are in fact truly working for and what in fact their mission goals, if you will, are. The intelligence agencies, through the budget process, through the accumulation of information process, have taken a huge chunk of power out of the executive branch in Washington. We all know that the senior official from the United States to kind of sneak into Ukraine just before a lot of bad things start to happen was the head of the CIA. We also know that the intelligence agencies either can vacuum up everything or they can't, but what we don't know really is how they choose to share that information, how it's disseminated throughout the government, and whether that information is being used or manipulated or withheld or parsed out in small bites in ways that can in fact influence American policy and cause certain policymakers to appear stronger in a situation or appear weaker in a situation. It's difficult to forget what happened in Syria earlier this year when it appeared once again that the United States had very little connection and knowledge of what was going on the ground. The White House flubbed around. Secretary Kerry embarrassed both himself and the United States by handing over the crisis resolution, if you will, to the Russians. Questions are there about how all this is working in Washington and what really is going on behind the scenes. I hesitate to add also the conversation between Victoria Nuland and her ambassador to Ukraine that was apparently recorded by the Russians and broadcast, which showed Nuland and the ambassador planning on how they were going to be manipulating events in the Ukraine, albeit unsuccessfully, and featured Ms. Nuland's famous remark where she suggests that the EU do something to themselves that's anatomically quite rude. That conversation was held on some unclassified Blackberries, unclassified cell phones. Anybody could have taped it. And the fact that the NSA was not monitoring that and trying to intercede or not providing the equipment that was necessary raises again in my mind the question of who's in charge and what's happening to this information that is being vacuumed up.
So when you mentioned Victoria Nuland and the intercepted conversation, first of all, I'm amazed that there's still neocons in the government, and particularly in the Obama administration, after they made such a disgraceful mess of American foreign policy and did so much damage. I know they've infiltrated the national security community fairly effectively, and they certainly have a lot of voices on television. But why in God's name Victoria Nuland is in that position? And furthermore, the critical moment in this whole catastrophe with Ukraine seems to have been when the EU put it to the Ukrainians, you're either with us or with Russia. There's no way that you can, there's any middle ground. They made it a zero-sum situation in offering entry into the EU. And that, of course, prompted Putin then to lean on Yanukovych, saying the same thing, you're either with me or with them. There's no other two ways. And he made it pretty clear that you got to be with Russia. That, to me, that kind of a diplomatic blunder that set this whole tragedy in motion. How come nobody on our side noticed that? Least of all Victoria Nuland. She may well have been a part of prompting it.
You're left in these situations with either risking sounding like a conspiracy theorist or risking simply saying that the people who are running America's foreign policy are blatantly incompetent. And I'm not sure which one kind of takes my fancy right now, but let's take a look at both of them. When you go to an extreme as an opening salvo in diplomacy, there's no place to back down from. Throughout my years in the State Department, we had regular sessions and classes and instructions on how to negotiate, how to conduct diplomacy. And the magic word was never put yourself in a corner and never put your opponent in a corner, because there's no more negotiation at that point. You've got to leave the door open so that you can get to your goal one way or the other. At the point where you say, it's our way or the highway, then in fact, you are requiring your opponent to choose one or the two, and you've just reduced your odds of success to no more than 50%. And so whether that kind of strategy, which, by the way, we've seen over and over again in the Obama administration, whether that kind of strategy reflects a power struggle in Washington between the intelligence agencies and other parts of the executive branch, or whether it represents simple incompetence, I'm not really sure which point of view would actually be worse. I'm tempted to believe that incompetence may be actually more dangerous than a thought-out process. At the same time, as you mentioned in your question, watching America once again plunge down a tunnel driven by neocon black and whiteism frightens me as an American, frightens me as a former diplomat, and leaves me wondering, after the Ukraine, what's next? Where else will we discover a new crisis that has to be resolved again with these hard-hammered techniques?
So, Peter Van Buren, the other aspect of this crisis, which has been long in its gestation, has been the eastward movement of NATO. While the EU deal was an economic deal, it wasn't about membership in NATO. The way that Putin and the Russians see it is that they'd end up with NATO on their border, on their western border. And they felt that was inevitable. And the Democrats don't want to take that off the table. I interviewed Strobe Talbott, who was Clinton's guy on Russia, who it was part and parcel of all this movement of NATO eastward. It's interesting to note that people like Henry Kissinger are opposed to NATO expansion and offering NATO membership to Ukraine, yet the Democrats are the ones that are encouraging it. So it's a bit strange to me. You know, it looks as if the Democratic hawks are more dangerous than the Republican hawks.
You've created a very odd situation here, Ian, where you're tricking me into agreeing with Henry Kissinger about something. But in fact, I'll have to concede the point to the great man here. The Russians have always, historically, been concerned about foreign armies encroaching on their borders. And NATO during the Cold War was clearly just another manifestation, a hyper-manifestation because of nuclear weapons. The Russians, you asked the question, well, what would a Ukrainian NATO represent? Would that significantly affect the defense of Western Europe? What would be the goal of threatening the Russians into a new move, which would certainly have to happen? I think that you're seeing the results of that kind of pigheadedness about, well, NATO has, or Ukraine has to become part of NATO because the countries to the east of them have become part of NATO, so we're just going to keep marching this thing eastward until the suburbs of Moscow are members of NATO. It is simply foolish, almost unbelievable, to think that those kind of moves by the United States, by the West, could go unanswered by the Russians, particularly being led by a hardliner like Vladimir Putin, who both remembers the old days and is not afraid to use his power and Russia's power in furtherance of his goals. Again, when you back people into corners, you cannot expect anything other than them to try to fight their way out. It's not good diplomacy. It's not smart foreign policy. And I don't think politically it's even a particularly good idea. It's very hard to imagine an outcome in the Ukraine that will make the White House and the Democrats look good going into the midterm elections.
Well, Peter Van Vuurman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. I'd be happy to come back anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Vuurman, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. And he has a new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, a story of the 99%. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.